In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Well, there was a pig farmer by the name of Ray Pollard who would go into the base with a flatbed truck each and every morning with empty garbage pails and would exchange them for food scraps for garbage from the mess halls to take and feed to his pigs. And he would overhear a sergeant from K-Squad talking about the strange people involved in a crash north of town at the very same time that the newspaper was publishing the press release claiming the Army had captured a flying saucer.
If you enjoy Conspiracy Unlimited, why not become a Conspiracy Unlimited Plus member? For just $1.99 per month, you'll gain access to 2 bonus, exclusive, commercial-free episodes per month, plus access to my back catalog of episodes. To subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Gain Access to Premium Episodes. Again, go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes, or click on the link in the episode notes. Conspiracy Unlimited Plus for less than $2 per month. Why not sign up today?
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs. Here Richard Serrett.
It's going to be a busy hour. We have company. Victor Vigiani, Executive Director of Zealand Communications, is in studio. We'll say hello momentarily to him. Standing by on the phone, Thomas J. Carey and Donald R. Schmidt, Roswell Investigators Extraordinaire. All four of us. That's right, all four of us in this tiny little room, and we'll be discussing their book, The Children of Roswell, A Seven-Decade Legacy of Fear, Intimidation, and Cover-Ups. At 1344 Bloor Street West, since 1947, when alien spacecraft crashed near Roswell, New Mexico, the historic incident has been well documented, described, researched, and explained in countless books, articles, and films. Now, two of the most reputable Roswell experts, Thomas J. Carey and Donald R. Schmidt, have at last exposed the turbulent and scandalous aftermath, the lifetime impact that Roswell has had on families who lived with the truth, all the while enduring the government's erroneous accounts of the event. In their bestseller, The Children of Roswell, A Seven-Decade Legacy of Fear, Intimidation, and Cover-Ups, the authors reveal evidence of years of suppression and fear of reprisal that these descendants of the Roswell witnesses have suffered from the U.S. government. Thomas Carey, Don Schmidt, welcome. How are you?
Good evening, Richard. Glad to be with you.
Hi, Richard. Good to be with you again.
Great to have you both. And Victor Vigiani, of course, from Zealand News Network. Let me see if there we are. Number two. Your microphone number two, Victor. How are you?
I'm just fine. Good to see you again and in fine form.
Hi,
Victor.
Hello, guys. How you doing?
All right.
That's fine.
Curious thing. I mean, you guys have dealt into so many different aspects of the Roswell UFO crash, but why now are you looking at the descendants, the children, as opposed to the adults? What's so special about the children?
Well, I think primarily for the fact that even throughout the course of our investigation, we've always been interviewing the families. Many times we've had the families take us aside. You know, I've been trying to get my husband to talk. We've been trying to get our father to talk for years without any success. And as a result, we often stayed in contact with the families. And little by little, we started to learn about a lot of the fear, a lot of the intimidation, about the late-night phone calls, about the strange occurrences that not only transpired in the aftermath of 1947, but in many cases, right up to their own deaths, right up even to today.
And now, of course, you know, we've lost, are there any original witnesses left? I don't believe. And now even the children, of course, are getting on. There aren't any original witnesses left, are there?
The original witnesses, mostly, you got to figure, Richard, if you're a 20-year-old Air Force person back in 1947, next year you'll be 90 years old.
Right, right. Exactly.
And most of those, I would say 99% of those are gone now that were at the Roswell base. Certainly, those involved, I can only think of one, off the top of my head, I can only think of one who might still be alive. As I called him a year ago, he was still alive. He was in his late 80s. But when you're that old, I mean, you could be gone the next day, you know? So, along the way, we started relying upon the children. Because oftentimes the children will speak if the parent has told the story to the child, where we would call up the participant when they were still alive. They would say, "Oh, I'm sworn to secrecy. I'm on a government pension. I don't want to mess up things. I like things the way they are. Goodbye." So we increasingly have relied on children, and now the children are starting to pass away. And increasingly, the grandchildren, the second and third generations. So that's where we're at.
We know about
the threats that the adults received by the military and the sheriff and Secret Service reports that they were on the ground there very quickly as well. The adults were certainly threatened. But are you hearing from the children that they were directly or indirectly threatened as well?
Well, certainly the best example, which we've cited for years, but which
have we lost Don? Or?
No, Don's here. We still have Don Thomas. Can you not hear Don?
I don't hear him now. No.
Go, Don. Try speaking to make sure Thomas can hear you.
Yes, Tom. Are you there?
Okay, Thomas.
Ground control to Major Tom.
All right, Thomas isn't hearing you. Thomas, are you hearing me?
I am hearing you. I just heard Don a second ago.
All right, good, good. Okay, so Don, you go ahead, and then Thomas, you can follow up. So again, one of you are going to give me an example of a child of Roswell who was threatened.
Well, certainly the best example, which we've cited for years, would be Frankie Rowe, who was the daughter of fireman Dan Dwyer with the Roswell Fire Department back in 1947. Who, after hearing about the crash north of town, personally went out in his own vehicle with another firefighter. But because of what her father, the fireman Dan Dwyer, had conveyed to her sister, their mother, and then what Frankie herself had observed when a state police officer by the name of Robert Scroggins had stopped by the firehouse with a piece of the wreckage from the actual debris field, the crash. And she was able to handle it and see that it had characteristics that even by today's accounts was something very strange, very bizarre. It had perfect memory. It would unfold and smooth out right before their eyes. And the military would actually come to her home later that day, sequestering her mother.
Hello?
And...
Oh, we still have Don Thomas. Sorry, we're talking with Don. You can't hear Don, but we'll try to fix this during the break.
Something's going on over the phones. I keep losing you.
All right, we will try and fix this during the break, Thomas, if you can hear me. Okay. Don was just finishing up on one of the children that were threatened.
Right, and in her case, she would overhear her mother being threatened that they would kill the children, that they would... take the children out into the desert, and nobody would ever see them again. And it still continues to smack in the face of those who still insist on believing that this was mundane, something conventional, something really as silly as a weather balloon device, as we are still led to believe by United States government officials. And yet, the very notion that they would have threatened children over that really, silly explanation on their part. Just still boggles the mind.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I am a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Every Town Podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio. A 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again. And Elizabeth Shove from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. And we give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Everytown Podcast, because Everytown no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
C60 Evo delivers the miracle molecule, ESS60. It's pure carbon 60. Why not love your body and share C60 Evo with those you love? ESS60 from C60 Evo is a mega antioxidant for increased strength, endurance, flexibility, and a deeper sleep. It's great for pets too. I take a tablespoon every day, and so does the mighty Aphrodite. We're both sleeping better than we have in years. And during the day, we have such tremendous energy and vitality. We're both pain-free. In a landmark peer-reviewed animal study in Paris, France, rats fed ESS60 lived twice their normal lifespan. Go to c60evo.com/richard-serrett or click on the C60 Evo link in the episode notes. Use the code EVRS at checkout and save 10%. ESS60 from C60 Evo. Order your miracle in a bottle today.
We're talking about the sons and daughters of Roswell witnesses and the years of abuse and surveillance by the U.S. government they have endured over the last seven decades. And co-authors Donald R. Schmidt and Thomas Carey are with us. Now, we are having some phone problems, and what is happening is that Don and Tom can both hear me, but they can't hear each other. So what we're going to do is, Don, you're going to stay with us, and then I'm going to let you go and bring Thomas on for the second half. Are you okay with that? I apologize, but...
No, I'm perfectly fine.
Okay, because we want to include Thomas in this as well, and unfortunately the phones just are not cooperating. But you can hear me now, and we've eliminated the feedback. So, let me turn things over to Victor Vigiani from Zealand Communications, and take it away, Victor.
Yeah, I guess the biggest thing, Don, that, in looking at some of the chapters that I've looked at, the incident with Dan Dwyer and Lee Reeves when they first went out there, when they made the first trip out there, and I'm trying to put this all together with respect to, you know, what the reaction of the Roswell Army Air Force was at the time, and they came in and they literally overwhelmed everybody because of what went on. And I can understand them doing that from the point of view of whatever landed might have been secret. I can handle that. But when these two guys apparently made the first trip out, they saw the crashed vehicle, okay? You used the term in the book, you and Tom used the word vessel. It was like an egg-shaped vessel. And then they saw these three bodies of some kind. And then someone looked off to the corner out of their eye and they said they saw one walking around kind of in a daze. To me, I don't know how many weather balloons or whatever it might have been would hold that kind of creatures in them to, you know, I just don't know. It really kind of confuses me. So that, to me, is a tip-off that something really, really bizarre happened.
Well, you raise an excellent point, Victor, and it's a point that the skeptics continue to harbor on, that until we started the investigation in the late 80s, that there was absolutely no mention of bodies, for example, no mention of any beings, any survivors, anything biological connected to this. That's why they're able to hold on to this balloon explanation, because they claim that it was all concocted by the researchers, by the investigators. And yet, all these families that we speak with, there is this constant reference to the little people, the little men,
mm-hmm.
going all the way back to the time of the incident. And one of the chapters, for example, and I'll mention this to both you and Richard as an example of still another firsthand witness that we just talked to as of last week, so obviously not contained within the book, but I'll quickly demonstrate how it's connected to one of the body witnesses, and that was the late Sergeant Melvin Brown, who was with K-Squad, the Kitchen Squad, for example. And keeping in mind that this was the first atomic bomb base in the world at that time, each and every personnel on that base had a top security clearance. And as a result, that if you worked in the mess hall, you also had a top security clearance. Well, Brown's story to his family, his wife Ada, his daughters Beverly and Harriet, right up until he died, was that he was posted behind an ambulance truck out at that site, out at that very same site that Dan Dwyer and Lee Reeves drove out to days before. And he was posted and told, keep his eyes forward. First chance he got, what did he do? He reached in behind him, lifted up a tarp, and there were a couple of the bodies. So he actually saw what he had only heard as rumors, the little people, the little men. Well, advance 2016. Well, there was a pig farmer by the name of Ray Pollard who would go into the base with a flatbed truck each and every morning with empty garbage pails and would exchange them for food scraps, for garbage from the mess halls to take and feed to his pigs at his pig farm. And he would overhear a sergeant from K-Squad talking about the strange people involved in a crash north of town at the very same time that the newspaper was publishing the press release claiming the Army had captured a flying saucer. So was it the same sergeant? But nonetheless, it was somebody still connected to the very same unit, the very same squadron.
Would you imagine?
20 years later, and according to him, his family that we've talked to, they were talking about it immediately after the event, and they've been talking about it all these years, long before Friedman and Moore and Randall and Schmidt and Kerry, any of us have been working on this. They were talking about the strange men involved in a crash north of Roswell, dating right back to the incident.
If they can eliminate this body issue, if when I say they, the people who want to debunk all of this, in addition to the government people that continue to harass these children, if they can eliminate the whole body issue, I guess Roswell goes up in smoke. But to my way of thinking, and even when you talk about the people that flew the bodies out of Wright-Patterson, I think it was one of the pilots described them putting the bodies into the crates. And
yes.
Yeah, and all of that, that's going to be...
That was O.W. Pappy Henderson, correct?
Pappy Henderson, right, yeah. That issue alone and the recurrence of the whole body issue sustains this matter to a point where, and even the constant, and even to this day, the harassment of these children, there's no way that people can disprove that something very, very different and very strange happened back in July of 1947. There's just no way they can eliminate this from being a matter of keen interest to the government. That's where...
Well, again, let's also cite, you know, two principal examples that the very same debunkers, the same skeptics cannot deny. If we talk about that infamous weather balloon press conference going up the chain of command over the 509th Bomb Group from Roswell to the 8th Air Force headquartered at Carswell Army Airfield in Fort Worth, Texas. And there the commanding officer of the 8th Air Force, Brigadier General Roger Ramey, brought the press in to photograph not the remains from Roswell, but a substituted weather balloon with a radar reflector kite. Mm-hmm. Even his very chief of staff, Colonel Thomas DeBose, then later a retired brigadier general, we have him signing a sworn affidavit. We have him giving a video deposition where he states the balloon was a hoax, that they were the ones who substituted the material, the balloon material, for the actual material. And General Ramey, in three of the photographs, is holding that telex, that piece of paper. And in one of them, you can make out a paragraph of text. And under extreme computer enhancement and scanning as far as analysis, you are able to read the line, the victims of the wreck. Well, there again, what victims connected to a weather balloon? Mm-hmm. They're right there. They're confirming some form of bodies associated with the wreck.
We
want to advance it up to 1997 when the Air Force had another press conference in Washington and they put out their fourth explanation, the wooden crash dummy, the anthropomorphic wooden crash dummy explanation. albeit 5 years removed. The project didn't even originate until 5 years after Roswell. Nonetheless, the Air Force felt compelled. They felt forced to come up with a rational explanation for all of the body reports, all of the body testimony. And to us, that was a major victory because the Air Force was demonstrating that they were acknowledging some semblance of bodies recovered.
Now, sticking with the alien bodies, Don, one of the daughters of one of the key witnesses to these bodies told you about discovering that her telephone had been bugged. How long did that go on for? Tell me about this witness, and how long was this surveillance?
The same witness we were talking about earlier, and that would be Frankie Rowe. When they had moved after she had married, and her husband, they moved up to Portales, which is about an hour northeast of Roswell. And it wasn't until around 1997, actually it was just before the 50th anniversary celebration, that they had a bad storm and a power outage and a phone outage. Technician came and, you know, repaired the phone line and came to the door, and he handed her this electronic device. And she didn't recognize it. She had no idea. She thought it was just some scrap wiring that he had replaced. And he informs her, you know, Mrs. Rowe, do you realize that somebody's been monitoring your phone use? Someone's been monitoring your phone calls. And she was shocked, obviously. But then she and her husband became angry, and she immediately realized that it had something to do with Roswell. She realized that the only reason that anybody would be concerned about who and what she was, you know, talking about was the fact that just within the 5 years before, she had first gone public. It was the first time that we had actually been able to interview her and have her actually describe to us her father's account, the physical threats of the military threatening to kill them, should the parents ever talk about this, and then her own personal recollection of handling a piece of the wreckage and how it possessed this perfect memory.
Well, that's
so
something.
Why would somebody, again, be so concerned?
Yeah. There's a part there, Don, in one of the chapters that I was looking at, where you talked about GIs would be coming and going, taking these parts from, I think it was Building 84 or Hangar P3, whatever it was.
It was both, right.
Yeah. Are they one and the same thing? They are.
Well, it was P3 and 47, and in recent years,
I see. Okay.
It's known as Building 84. Correct?
Yeah, my question is, some of the GIs would take great fun in taking some of these parts of the debris, you know, segments of the debris, and trying to take them to you know, mechanics of some kind to drill through them or heat them or, I mean,
welding shops.
Yeah, that's right.
Attempt to cut with acetylene torches.
Of
and
course.
Welding arc.
Yeah. I mean, advanced material like that, my goodness.
And so there's a pattern of activity, of behavior, not only on the part of civilians involved, but also the military, as to the strained characteristics of this wreckage. And that's something that, whether it is the government here in the States or even authors and researchers who do attempt to come up with alternative explanations, they never address the wreckage. The bodies, they never address what the witnesses who handled it, who saw them firsthand, are describing. And they're not describing anything that I'm aware of, or I would defy anyone to come up with a rational explanation as to what these people are describing, as to the true nature of the wreckage and the bodies recovered at Roswell.
Another witness to the bodies. I never knew about New Mexico Lieutenant Governor Joseph Montoya until I talked to you,
yes.
Don. I hadn't heard that tale. And does he have children, living children, and does that enter into this at
yes,
all? Have you
does.
Talked to them?
And other relatives who we have spoken with, we had even spoken to his widow, his wife, very early on into our investigation. And we always ran up against a brick wall. Fortunately, some of his personal friends, for example, both Pete and Ruben Anaya, they were members of the Democratic Party at that time. They were schoolmates, and they were the ones who essentially rescued him from out at the base. He was out at that same that very hangar, P3. He was originally there. It was the 4th of July weekend. He was there for the unveiling of a new aircraft, and he calls up and get me basically the hell out of here. Get me out of here. Pick me up right now. I'll be at the water tower, which is just down from P3, and they pick him up. He's in the back seat, and, you know, he's just beside himself, and then finally he blurts out, they weren't human. They weren't human. And to us, we've spent much time trying to confirm exactly where the lieutenant governor was at that time. We can tell you exactly where the governor was, but we cannot find, given it's a 4th of July weekend, and there would have been all types of parades and ceremonies and rodeos and festivals, there is not a paper in the entire state of New Mexico that identifies where Joseph Montoya, the very lieutenant governor at that time, was. So we find that rather unusual as well.
All right. Don, listen, we are going to say goodbye to you and then welcome your co-author, Thomas Carey, back for the last half of this particular segment. So I want to thank you and congratulate you on the Children of Roswell.
Well, thanks for your help as always, Richard and Victor. Thank you to both of you. Always great to be with you. I look forward to the next time.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the hosts of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common. A single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
I use Life Change Tea from Get the Tea every morning, and it's made such a huge difference in my life. Buy a one-year supply of Super Strength Life Change Tea and start feeling rejuvenated right now. Life Change Tea is not the same tea you buy in a store off the shelf. Life Change Tea from Get the Tea has 8 powerful herbs blended together to maximize your health. This tea is specially formulated to help cleanse your kidneys, liver, colon, and blood. All at once. The colon is one of the most ignored organs in the human body. The faster that waste is eliminated from the body, the less time that waste sits in our intestines, spreading toxins to our bloodstream. The benefits of this product go way beyond what I've listed here. Do your research and start your day with a cool, refreshing 16-ounce glass of Super Strength Life Change Tea. It's non-GMO, organic, caffeine-free, and again, not available in any store. Use the code UNLIMITED and all your orders ship for free. So, go on. Get your tea from GetTheTea.com.
As you're staring up at the night sky, ever wonder who's staring back? No, me either. But I guess you better say it because of Richard. You know, he's all wrapped up in this stuff. Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
All right, welcome back. We have said goodbye to the Children of Roswell co-author Don Schmidt. Due to some telephone complications, I won't bore you with the details, but we can't have both guests on at the same time. So we now welcome back Thomas J. Carey, the other author of The Children of Roswell. Victor Vigiani remains in studio from Zealand Communications. Thomas, thank you for your patience and welcome back.
Well, nice to be with you again, Richard, and Victor.
All right. We were mentioning, you know, now we're losing the children of Roswell, and of course, one of those would be Jesse Marcel Jr. You talk about in the book the how the U.S. Air Force tried to get him to change his story. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and then I'll turn things over to Victor?
Yes. Jesse Marcel Jr., Don and I both knew very well. A finer person you can never hope to meet. He was just a wonderful man. He was a ear, nose, and throat doctor. He had, I believe, he flew helicopters. He was called back to military. He was a 10-year service veteran, and at age 69, I believe he was called back to service in Iraq, and he served two tours of duty, you know, from age 69 to early 70s in Iraq. And just a finer man you never want to meet. And he was 11 years old at the time of the Roswell incident, and his father, before he came back from the crash site with a car full of the wreckage, he stopped off at home to show his wife and his son, Jesse Jr. And so Jesse, they spread out some of the material on the kitchen floor, and this was really strange. And Jesse told us that his father, even at that time, believed that the wreckage was from what they used to call flying saucers. Now we call them extraterrestrial spaceships, UFOs. Anyway, over the years, they had been advised, and that's using a gentle term, that they were threatened not to talk about this ever again, and they didn't for 30 years, until Jesse Sr. was getting near the end of the trail, and he started talking about his experience back in 1947 over his ham radio network. He was a member of a ham radio group, and, you know, they talk, you know, over this, you know, breaker, this is KXOA, and things like that. So, anyway, so Jesse Jr., now Jesse Sr. died in 1986. Jesse Jr. picked up the baton, and when interviewers came calling, because the case was now out since 1980 with the first book, The Roswell Incident, researchers came calling, and Jesse Jr. picked up the baton and started talking about what he knew. So, along about 1993-94, the General Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress in the United States, were tasked by Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico to try to find out about what took place at Roswell. So the General Accounting Office, they started to a search for documents, you know, like telexes and phone messages and things that might have been generated from the Roswell base at that time to shed some light on what was going on. And the net result was that they declared that all of those documents were missing, had been destroyed by unknown authority. Well, moving along, Jesse Jr., every time now he's becoming well known because he's speaking out about what he knew, and he's an honest guy. He said that I held a piece of he called it an I-beam with strange symbols on it, and he said he remembers it distinctly to this day. Things like that, and what his father had told him. And every time Jesse was scheduled to go to an event, he would receive these anonymous phone calls. threatening him not to continue with this speaking out. Every time he went to an event where he was a speaker, which was often, he received these phone calls. And the Air Force in 1994, along with the Stephen Schiff investigation, the Air Force decided to quote-unquote reopen, and I use that term lightly, their investigation of the Roswell case. And they cherry-picked witnesses, only had a few of them, and they came up with this Project Mogul explanation, these high-altitude balloon arrays that were designed to carry aloft up into the stratosphere these acoustic sensors to hopefully listen in and stay up there with constant level balloons. And way high up in this certain level of the stratosphere where sound waves apparently are very well amplified and carry long distances in the hope of detecting the Soviet Union's first detonation of an atomic device. Well, that's their explanation today, was this Project Mogul. Well, chief investigator was a fellow by the name of, he was a captain, James McAndrew. And he called up Jesse Jr., who had personally seen the wreckage. He knew it was strong, thin, metallic pieces, and some of it was memory metal. Some of them were these I-beams with strange symbols on them. Well, McAndrew, he was like he was cross-examining like a hostile witness. And he got Jesse to accept the Air Force position that these I-beams were really masking tape, which were used in the construction of these radar targets, these rubber balloon carried tinfoil radar targets. They used baling twine and this scotch tape with these with flowers on them. So it's like a lawyer cross-examining a hostile witness. It was more like haranguing. And here, you have Captain James Andrew haranguing retired Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr. So there's a little irony there. But he said, what is it going to take for you to accept that what you handled was just scotch tape with funny flowers on it? And Jesse never wavered. He never wavered. He took all of the abuse that McAndrew was handing out, and his story never changed. I don't know if you ever interviewed Jesse Jr., Richard.
Yes, I did.
You know
both
the kind of person
did.
I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
And so he never wavered until the day he died.
Right.
It was in 2013. I had met with him. He was down in Roswell for the festival, as Don and I are always down there in July, and we shared a bale of hay, sitting on a bale of hay in a parade down Main Street. And we were both sitting there looking at one another, what are we doing here on this bale of hay? But heck of a nice guy. I just can't see him telling something, an untruth. I just can't. But they harassed him, you cannot believe, because they targeted Jesse Sr. first, and then when Jesse Sr. died, they targeted Jr. because they were unimpeachable. They were unimpeachable. But if you take them down, there's a good chance you take Roswell down and, the fallout from that.
All right. So, Victor Vigiani, go ahead.
I want to address two things, Tom. First of all, the skeptics always, they hang their hat on the fact that, well, you know, there's no solid proof. I'm not just talking about this incident, but generally speaking about the whole UFO ET issue. There's no solid proof. We don't have any, you know, vehicles. We don't have any, you know, parts. We don't have any ashtrays from the flying saucers. I'm being tongue-in-cheek, of course.
No headlights.
Yeah, exactly, right. In this case, it seems to have every single component. If you brought this case to a court of law, it would have everything from bodies to debris to government harassment to FBI memos to all kinds of documents. It has everything to it. And
except physical evidence.
Exactly. It's got everything that any lawyer would want to have to pursue this case in a court of law. So I guess that leads me to my next question, is how much more do you guys need to push this thing forward to get some sort of hearing or some sort of investigation through the government, not just have, you know, us talk about it on the radio, but it couldn't, can they ever resurrect this issue and bring it forward in a quasi court of law or you know, a congressional hearing to say, let's get to the bottom of what happened at Roswell because we've got all the evidence. So let's just stop ragging the puck here.
Well, Don and I are not holding out for any government action. That's not on our radar scope. I just don't believe there ever will be any because the civil rights violations that they committed starting in 1947, they do not want to account for. And they also don't want to account for a 70-year-old lie. They've been telling a lie about this for 70 years now. And now to admit, all of a sudden, oh, yes, folks, we've been lying to you, yes, for 70 years. Then the question becomes, well, what else are you lying to us about? So we just don't see that ever happening. What it will take, Victor, is one of three things. Either a case that is just so compelling that hasn't happened yet. A landing on the White House lawn is the vernacular. Something like that's on television, everybody sees it, and there's just no way around it. The other is, I mean, we have the witnesses. We have hundreds of witnesses, from doctors and lawyers to, laborers to you name it. We have that type of witness. Or we come into an irrefutable piece of physical evidence. And we thought we had that last year with this, and I don't want to get into the Roswell slide story. It's a long story. But we thought we had irrefutable evidence there with these slides that were presented to us, that were located, and we did 3 years of due diligence on us, with all of the arrows pointing to yes, 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 and in the end it turned out no. Perhaps it's still in my mind. I'm still in a little bit of disbelief as to what happened, and it's the door is not fully closed on that. And I, like I said, I don't want to get into it. It's a really long story. It took us 3 years to present what we knew.
No, let's focus for sure on that
question. It will either take a compelling event involving a UFO that there's just no way that you can no other way to explain it, or we come into a piece, and we are still looking for a piece of the memory metal, the so-called metal that you can wad up in your hand and then let it go, and it'll just flow out like water and straighten out and is indestructible, something like that. And you can tell that just by looking at it, that we don't have anything like that still, as opposed to something, say, like a stiff piece of metal. You know, you can explain away wreckage, except some piece that is so exotic. And that's the memory metal that there can be no other explanation. So that's what I see. And I don't see the government, even though Hillary Clinton was heard to, well, she stated, I guess about a week or two ago, that she believes that we may have already been visited. Well, I'm guessing that she read our book, because we know that Bill Clinton has a copy of our book, Witness to Roswell. It was presented to him. We know he has it. I don't know if he read it, but I'm guessing that Hillary read it, because she says she wants to find out more about UFOs, and perhaps we've already been visited. She wasn't sure.
We've got about 2 minutes here, and Victor's got one more question burning a hole in his pocket, so let's get that. Well, yeah, actually, the hole has just been replaced by another burning one. The idea of the pledge that she made to John Podesta and the pledge that John Podesta made to Hillary, both are sort of in the same direction, saying to one another that I'm counting on you to get this information out. How serious, I don't know if you've heard that or not, but that was part of the pledge in the Conway Daily Sun. Both of them were quoted as saying that. Yeah.
The track record on that, Victor, is not good. It goes all the way back to Lyndon Johnson, who talked about getting the UFO information out when he was running for vice president in 1960. And you remember Jimmy Carter saying he was going to get the stuff out, and it never happened.
But it's John Podesta who's saying that right now. That's a different story.
And now it's John Podesta and Hillary, but I'm just telling you that the track record on follow-through when those types of statements is not good.
I've got one question.
A president has many problems to solve, the economy, a war, and all of that. And the subject of UFOs, as you know, Victor, is still taboo in many, many areas. And politics is one of those. Professional people, they don't want their name on the same page as the term UFO. Lawyers, doctors, politicians, people in the limelight that depend on their credibility for their livelihood, UFOs is not one thing they want to be associated with.
Thomas, let me see if I can work in.
Actually, I knew John Podesta was interested in this, but I'm surprised that Hillary said something.
Thomas, let me see if I can work in one more. We've got about a minute here and not enough time, really, but let's just touch upon it. And that is one of there is a disappearance associated with Roswell, a key witness in 1960. Tell us about the disappearance of this witness and what her children are saying.
Well, were you talking about Vernon Brazel?
Oh, I was thinking about, was it there not, Glenn Dennis talked about meeting a woman, a nurse on the
Army? Oh, the nurse. Oh, that is such a long story, but that was a phony story by Glenn Dennis. It was actually another nurse. We know who the nurse is. She worked at a doctor's office. The doctor was called to the base. She went with him. But her husband worked in the same funeral home as Glenn Dennis in the same capacity as an embalmer. So we believe that Glenn Dennis got the story from the nurse's husband, a fellow embalmer at Ballard's funeral home. He made it his own because he used the nurse as his foil. Knowing that this certain nurse who's in the base yearbook was already dead. So he used her. He admitted to us that he gave us a phony name for the nurse. So if you're in a court of law and you're caught lying, you are impeached totally as a witness. You are dead as a witness, and he lied to us about the name of the nurse. But we've been working on this for years, and we believe we have solved who this nurse is. And how Glenn Dennis was able to come by this story. It came from the nurse's husband.
Ah, okay.
And, the doctor who was called, his son is still living, and he's a doctor also in Roswell. And I've interviewed him myself, and it's still an ongoing lead investigation on that particular doctor. So,
all right, fair enough, Thomas.
We have that solved.
All right. I appreciate your time tonight. In the meantime, congratulations on the Children of Roswell, a seven-decade legacy of fear, intimidation, and cover-ups. Thank you for this. Victor Vigiani, my friend, thank you. Until next time.
Looking forward to it, as always.
All right. Very quickly, Zealand Communications, how do we access that?
Just Google the word Zealand Communications, and you'll come up with the blog and our website.
All right, and my website, strangeplanet.ca. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. As always, follow the truth.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need... We need constant petting.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.